content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today, from the September 16th and 23rd, 2019 editions of the New Yorker magazine, I will read a short story by Thomas McGuan and an article describing a diary written by Zuzanna Jussman during her imprisonment in a Nazi concentration camp in 1944. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the September 23, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine. Wide Spot by Thomas McGuan. The small bore politics that I've been caught up in for the past 30 years has provided, beyond the usual attractions of graft and corruption, a vivid lesson in regional geography, as if I've had to make sure my constituents would keep showing up to vote. Still, it had been a very long time since I'd last visited Prairiedale. Back then, the town was known as Wide Spot. It wouldn't have had a name at all if it weren't for the filling station there, and had anyone thought about it, would have been called something more dignified like Fort Lauderdale. In the old days, the Indians led their cattle to the freight yards many miles away on horseback. Their wives awaited them in Model T Fords, pulled their saddles off the horses, and drove them back to the reservation. The horses turned up on the res within a week, grazing their way north on unfenced grass. But when the Northern Pacific laid a spur from the east-west line to pick up cattle and grain, Wide Spot boomed, became the county's seat. It got a courthouse, a sprawl of frame houses, a fire station and a Quonset hut, a baseball diamond, and its unimaginative name. Lately, the combination of agriculture and local mining had made Prairiedale a politically divided town. I decided to visit my half of the divide as part of my sweep, and just to feel the sweet ache of old days, mine gone by. I'd been there in my youth when I played keyboards for the Daft during our short heyday as a regional band. Once the band decided to pack it in, we felt that Wide Spot would be the perfect place to celebrate the end of our inconsequential run. We were delighted to see the Rainbow Horizon Bar fill up with cowboys and cowgirls, but then Wide Spot was the only place to go within a very large radius. Now, when I drove into town, nothing had changed, except that I was quick to notice that the old Rainbow Horizon Bar had become an appliance store and secondhand clothing drop. There was a dog sleeping in the doorway that did not appear anxious to move. The first side street in town seemed abandoned. There were small houses, possibly the homes of former laborers at the defunct talc mine nearby, but no sign of life, except for the crows pecking along the street and around the trunk of a sagging linden. I thought this street might have been where we'd bought that pot that gave us all a headache and a slight sense of dislocation. Its only value was that it entitled us to say that we were smoking pot. It stank up our van so badly that we threw away the tie-dyed curtains. Halfway down the street was a narrow three-story brick building with a sewing machine store on the first floor, probably an apartment on the second, with Tibetan prayer flags in the window. The third floor was filled to the ceiling with mattresses that pressed against its windows. In front was a chopper bike with Sturgis stickers and expired New Mexico plates. Of the next seven houses, four appeared empty and one had broken windows. I was looking for the county chair of my party, who, the notes on my phone said, was one Cornell Bowen, an official with the savings and loan, which I could see at the end of the street. In the great river of American politics, I am no more than an endangered snail darter. But like other politicians, big and small, I am to some extent mortified to even have the job. Getting along by going along is what got us all here. But as my dad, an alcoholic dentist, used to say about staring into dirty mouths, It's a living. The first political speech I ever gave on the virtues of Westerners up at Fort Peck went over quite well with the crowd, though my cousin Earl came up to me afterward and said, "You sounded like 10 pounds of feces in a 6-pound sack." I should have quit while I was ahead, but public respect trumped self-respect in my book. A vulture standing amid the flowers in front of the savings and loan was undeterred by an irate employee shouting and waving a clipboard. Whoa, something new. I stepped in to flush the bird and found that it was dead and stuffed. Clipboard pressed to her hip, the woman cried, "Why would anyone do such a thing?" I said, "It's a vulture. Do you know what vultures stand for?" I'm always saying the wrong things to women, or maybe it's how I say them. She shot me an annoyed glance, and as she started toward the front door of the building, I called out, "I'm looking for Cornell Bowen." She gave me the same wintry smile my ex-wife used to say for quiet evenings by the fire. "No longer with us. Goodbye. Take the bird with you." She shut the door before I could explain that I hadn't put the dadgum vulture in the flowers, and then she popped back out. "I suppose you're with the papers. This SNL doesn't need your explanation of what vultures stand for. Bowen is at the courthouse treasurer's office. Nobody here understands how he got from here to there. You can drop the bird off at his office with our compliments." Nothing bespeaks times gone by. Good times that won't come back, like courthouses in towns like this. All the slate, sandstone, granite, marble, copper, and nostalgic European architecture towering over a residential population without the wherewithal to fix the pipes. In the corridors, desks whose occupants never look up, a smell of mildew and old wood, ghosts at their roll tops, the pleasant melancholy that Civil War buffs must feel on the blood-soaked killing grounds. Bowen didn't acknowledge me. He looked like an aging surfer dude, or what I imagined an aging surfer dude might look like. He was tanned, handsome, and his gray hair had a hint of blonde. He stared at his paperwork with parted lips and an air of despair befitting someone torn from better days. "Cornell," I said, after introducing myself, "I'm making my way around the state, visiting all the good folks." When you campaign in Montana, it's folks, not people or persons, folks, 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 and more folks. All the good folks who supported me the last time, hoping that what I've accomplished will have them on board for the next cycle. "Well, I didn't support you." "Do what?" "Nor would I." I examined my phone as though it might explain the mistaken entry in my notes. "I thought you were running for state auditor." "Not running for state auditor," Cornell recited. "Is that a real Rolex?" "Oh, hell no," he said, as though I were an idiot. "And you're no longer at the savings and loan?" "No." "Did you leave the stuffed vulture in the flowers?" "I have no idea what you're talking about." I smiled amiably at this disclaimer. "I have another reason for visiting Prairiedale. I once had a band, the Daft."
"The what? A band? Here?"
What gave me the urge to paint a romantic picture of the old days in Widespot? I suppose I'd hoped he'd change his tune once he understood that I had local memories and a politician's knack for filling the air with pleasant nattering. I told him how we'd toured around the state, knocking off Grand Funk Railroad, the Doobie Brothers, and Forgotten Hair Bands, and how this had been our last stop. "We disbanded right here, Cornell. It wasn't a great band, but we had a great singer, Micah Clardy, a great voice." Cornell leaned forward at this. "And we knew that he deserved to be famous. Micah, he's like, I'm going to L.A. And he was perfect for that kind of crossover country thing. Anyway, handsome guy, unbelievable pipes."
"He's still here."
"Who's still here?"
"Micah Clardy. I thought he was always here. Old Mr. Fix-It."
I wanted another town and accurate information. Bowen told me dismissively where to find Micah, in the house with the Tibetan prayer flags and the old chopper, and returned his dead stare to his papers. I didn't need him anymore and left without a word. I looked forward to telling my old bandmate how our days on the road had helped launch my career. I was never important to the band. I could hardly play my keyboards, and the ironic contrast could be fun, because now I was really going places. Still, as I walked toward Micah's apartment, I felt fearful of seeing him again. He'd been a strict band leader and had often hurt my feelings by signaling out my incompetence. I considered skipping it and leaving town, heading to a more reliable stop on my campaign trail. But it would only be another prairie town, where the future of the post office was under review and the landowners lived elsewhere. The rear tire of the chopper was flat. The gazette was stuck between the screen and the door. I knocked, and the door opened partially. I saw lips poking out of a goatee and heard a shout. "We don't sell sewing machines anymore!" I said that I was there to see Micah Clardy. "Side entrance!" Slam. I made my way around the building into the alley and found the stairs to the second floor and the bright blue paint of Micah's door. He was standing there, probably no more aged than me, but exceptionally weathered. I told him who I was, but in question form, as though I weren't sure. He squinted and said in the most measured way, "Holy cow!" and then stepped away from the door and swung his arm back for me to enter. I said, "Was I supposed to call? Now or then?" "That's a great question." Micah laughed too and joined me inside. He hadn't lost his lean, broad-shouldered look, though he now had a laborer's hands. As before, he gave the impression of being well-dressed, despite the stains in his painter's pants and a worn snap-button shirt with the tails out. He got us ice water and motioned me to a seat before making a practice fall into an armchair. It was a cheerful room, bright clouds in the windows. After a long stretch to clink glasses, I looked up at a large black-and-white photograph of a beautiful woman, high cheekbones, dreamy smile, like Jean Tierney. "Girlfriend?" "Daughter." With effort, I took my eyes off the picture. This was an all-purpose room, refrigerator, television, four-place dining table, a bookcase, yellow walls, a dog sleeping under the table, curtains tied back with a bungee cord, and a hummingbird feeder. A peculiar row of stuffed animals lined the wall below the window, a duck, a badger, a raccoon, a heron. Micah noticed me looking at them. A friend of mine closed up his taxidermy shop and went to work as a 12-hour derrick hand on an oil rig. He gave those critters to me. There was also a vulture. I put it in front of the savings and loan. They think Cornell Bowen put it there. Oh, good, he's a crook, but so is everyone else here. It struck me that a refrigerator and a television were rarely in a room together. "So you're still here," I said. "What'd you do with the van?" "It was up on blocks for years, then I gave it to my kid, and it got forfeited. I skipped all the hell I'd had with my kid and leaped forward to something more to my credit. I suppose you know I'm in the legislature." "Really? What are you going to do there?" "As we meet the challenges ahead, I'd like to show our fellow Montanans a better way to a sustainable future." I held my hand before me as though showing the way to the future. I already felt exposed when Micah burst into laughter. "Oh, cut it out. You're breaking my balls." I was shocked. I began again. "Well, that's the positive stuff. My home life never worked out. First wife was a paralegal named Sue who left me for an RV dealer. The second wife was a big, busted, broken arrow buckle bunny. Bomb-grade sex drive. Poor-end Wranglers. Her boyfriend lost everything at the bucking horse sale and stranded her in the Range Riders bar where I was with a client. I was suing a Miles City LLC over a grass lease default on some rangeland between Hathaway and Rosebud. That marriage was longer than the first one by 719 days, and all I got was debt. I thought this was a stylish summary, and it seemed to break the ice with Micah. He went to the window and talked while he looked down into the street. I was under that old music spell when my daughter was born. Called her Maybelline. My dad, my uncles, all tradesmen, ladder racks in their trucks. Chain smokers, knights at the Legion. I didn't want to go down that road. That last show we played was so great. Hot girls and pissed off cowboys. Rhonda and I locked ourselves in the van while you guys stood around. She was with the daughter of the State Farm agent. Drove a big white Ford Crown Vic with a police car engine. I went to L.A. hoping to be somebody. And then Rhonda called to tell me she was pregnant. I've been here ever since. Doing what? Plumbing, roofing, a little electrical, exactly like my uncles. Rhonda died of cancer. Single dad for 2 years, and then MB went to nursing school, got married, and moved to Lewistown, taught me to Skype. I'm sort of the mayor here. I get called that. How about this? I turned over a wastebasket and started thumping out a beat, doing my best to hum the opening chords of a Grand Funk Railroad song we'd played that last night. We tried to harmonize a few lines. Take me down to the water, let me feel it run over me, let me feel the pain and the coldness, the loneliness. Micah said, let's not do this. I don't know what I was thinking. I'd embarrassed us. I stood up, averted my face. So I need to roll. Michael followed me to the door. Signs to hang, I shrugged. Micah said, maybe this time I'll register. It felt like he'd reached out to me, and I was touched. A thunderstorm darkened the road toward Jordan, and storm clouds soared to the east, and the tires hissed. I was thinking of that Chuck Berry song, Rainwater Blowing All Under My Hood. I knew that was doing my motor good. At the wheel and with a back seat full of signs, I rarely saw myself so clearly, and I can't say I liked it. I thought of Micah. He had the same detachment I remembered from our band days. But girls had always focused on Micah, thanks to his good-looking rockabilly style, which went with his pompadour and his moves. I thought of Maybelline, whose entrancing picture was hanging so close behind Micah that I was able to shift my eyes to it easily, undetected, and often. I remembered Rhonda, too. She'd hung around the stage that night and didn't look like she knew what she was getting into. Country girl. Lewistown was not on my tour, but that was where Maybelline lived. So what was wrong? There was no law against turning up. I pressed on into the twilight, cell phone on my thigh as I scrolled through Lewistown telephone numbers. Since her listing included an address, the temptation to park across the street for a sustained look-see was compelling. The Missoula paper had described me as a gentleman politician, which indicated that I was either a gentleman or had a private income. Since only the first could be true, I took it on myself to call instead. Maybelline answered suspiciously. I made my case, running for office, single, semi-acquaintance of her dad, wanted to avoid age bracket as long as possible, and in town for a meet and greet. I told her that if she felt like taking a leap of faith, she might find I had plenty to offer. Well, that's exciting, she said. Can I think about it and call you back? I see your number. Well, sure you can. I'm crossing my fingers. I pulled off into a strip mall. All the stores were closed, but I parked in front of the J.C. Penney, where there was a good light. I read weather reports on my phone while I waited, just to keep my mind from bouncing around. At last, the phone rang, and I left it in my lap for a bit to avoid seeming in a hurry. Then I answered in a low, modulated voice. No better way to spook women than by talking too fast. I just got a call from Maybelline. Says you called. Says you're in town. It was Micah. Well, sure, yes. More of a courtesy call than anything. Tell you what. If you can stay there for a couple of hours, I'll come over and kill you. No, no, no. I'm on my way, actually. Good one. And I know what this is really about. Do you? And what is that? You never wanted me in the band. I felt a sense of exhausted relief at finally being able to say this. You delusionist idiot. You're a perfect politician. Something I could take as a compliment. Still, leading indicators were negative, and it was time to hit the road. I put up a few signs and was soon on my way to another town. Always one more town. You never know what's next. And that is why I can say with all honesty that I am not a depressed person. Unlike Mr. Fix-It, I have a future, and I don't intend to fade. And now, from the personal history section of the September 16th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, My Terezin Diary and What I Did Not Write About by Susanna Justman. On a freezing day in January 1944, after my family and I had been confined at Terezin for 6 months, my mother was arrested by the SS and placed in a basement cell in the dreaded prison at their camp headquarters. Not even her lover, who was a member of the Terezin Altstetzenrat, or Council of Elders, the Jewish governing body, could get her released. I was 12 years old, and I was afraid that I would never see her again. But on February 21, 1944, all I wrote in my diary was, "Mommy was away from us." What is most striking to me today about the diary I kept 75 years ago is what I left out. I kept the diary from December 8, 1943, until March 4, 1944, the first winter of the 2 years I was imprisoned with my parents, Victor Pick and Marie Pickova, and my brother, Bobby, in the Czech concentration camp. The camp was also known as Theresienstadt. In addition to 8 entries, it contains a few drawings, a poem about snow, and a story dealing with Terezin morality. Right after the war, I added a list of my girlfriends, marking the names of those who did not survive with a minus sign. When I first returned to the diary many years ago, I found it difficult to read. In rereading my diary this time, I became more tolerant of my youthful writing and allowed myself to remember the sadness and the loneliness that motivated it. Some children who kept diaries in Terezin wanted to document life around them. I wrote mine mostly to relieve my loneliness. It begins and ends with a wish to find a friend. I was longing for someone who would share my secrets and listen to my troubles. But in fact, I was not completely without friends during this time. Mariana Kornova and Jiri Sats both lived close to me. Mariana was a gifted writer, and she and I liked to collect words and expressions that struck us as exotic. We wrote them down on little pieces of paper that we sometimes buried. I still have a scrap of pink paper with inflagranti and negligees written on it. I knew Jiri from the Jewish school in Prague, where he was the most popular boy in my class. In Terezin, my mother and I had been assigned places in the attic, a large area under the roof of Q306, a two-story house divided into two sections with about 40 women and children on either side. When I arrived at my new quarters, I was thrilled to see that his bed was not far from mine. Jiri, or Jirka, as I called him, had a 9-year-old brother, Pretisic, who used to entertain the attic inhabitants in the evening by performing cabaret-style songs. The adults were convinced that he would grow up to be a big star and adored him. But Jirka and I thought he was annoying and would try to escape him when he followed us around. Jirka's job was to herd sheep on the camp ramparts. I sometimes sat with him while he was watched them, and one day he engraved, "Here Sots Herded Sheep in the Year 1944, on a little wall high up on the ramparts, with our initials J and Z intertwined underneath." A few years ago, the inscription was still there. Mariana, Jirka, and Prestrichek all perished in Auschwitz. Because I was fearful that the diary could fall into German hands and bring harm to my family, I rarely expressed myself freely in it. I did not mention my mother's arrest. I wrote with naive caution, "Until the age of 8, I led a normal life. But then a foreign nation entered my country," which I must have imagined would be less offensive to a potential Nazi reader than saying straight out that Germany had invaded Czechoslovakia. In an attempt to provide better living conditions for Terezin's children, the Jewish administration had opened so-called Kinderheime for girls and boys. About half the camp's children lived in these homes. When I described the classes that I attended in Terezin girls' Kinderheim, I carefully added, "We mostly play and read." Which was not true. We studied various subjects, such as English and Judaism. I had inserted this sentence because teaching was forbidden in the ghetto. And the Germans were not the only ones I worried about. "I sit by the stove," I wrote, "and I am constantly turning around to see if anyone watches what I am writing." In a place where there was no privacy, I tried to protect my diary from intruding glances. I realize now that there was not a moment when I believed that it was completely safe from unwanted readers, rather Nazi or curious neighbors. But that was not the only thing that kept me from writing frankly. The biggest hindrance, I now see, was my fear of my own feelings. Shortly after our arrival in Terezin, my parents joined an underground group that had been formed newly to receive food packages smuggled in from the outside. When the organizer was captured, he gave the SS my mother's name. My parents had been advised to sign up with the group using her name, since it was believed that a woman who was arrested was less likely than a man to be shot. My usually cautious parents were hardly the type to engage in dangerous activities. But soon after we got to Terezin, we had finished eating most of the food we had brought with us, and we were hungry. As part of our meager rations, each of us received a quarter of a small oval loaf of rye bread. I would keep cutting thin slices off my portion just to even it out a little, I'd say, and so it never lasted the 3.5 days it was supposed to. When we had an extra potato, we passed it from one family member to another. "You have it," and what we called Jewish ping pong. Although the Nazis referred to Terezin as a model ghetto, nearly one of every four people confined in the camp died there. Among the prisoners were some of the best doctors from Czechoslovakia, Germany, Austria, and Holland. But given the lack of medicines and of nutritious food, there was little they could do to combat the diseases that ravaged the place. The pre-war population of Terezin, a garrison town dominated by barracks and surrounded by ramparts, was about 7,000, both soldiers and civilians. After it was converted into the camp, at times it housed between 50 and 60,000 people, its streets so jammed that I found it hard to walk without bumping into someone. We lived under the constant threat of transport east, and our fears of deportation were justified. Most of Terezin's prisoners were eventually transported to Auschwitz. Few returned. The morning my mother was arrested, two men from the Jewish administration came to take her away. She had a few minutes to get ready. On the advice of one of our neighbors, she put on as many layers of clothing as she could. When the three of them left, I followed. I waited outside the Magdeburg barracks, the seat of the Jewish administration, where they spent about an hour, and then I followed them, at a safe distance, to SS headquarters. I had to stop at the barricade that separated the prison from the rest of the camp. and I waited there for many hours, hoping to see my mother come out again. In my haste to dress, I had forgotten to put on socks. It was very cold, and the back of my heels became frostbitten. I finally had to leave in order to get back to my quarters by the 8 o'clock curfew. What was left of our family was scattered. My father had been assigned to the men's barracks. Bobby, then 18, had contracted polio and was in one of the camp hospitals, partially paralyzed. Once my mother was gone from our quarters in the attic, I got up early every morning and ran to my father's barracks to make sure that during the night he, too, had not been arrested. A few days after my mother's arrest, a kind Czech gendarme brought us a message from her. It instructed me to come to the barricade near the prison at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and chat with the Jewish ghetto wachman, a ghetto policeman, standing guard there. Using a chain that hung from the narrow window at the top of her cell, she planned to hoist herself up and try to catch a glimpse of me. I went to the barricade every afternoon. It was very cold, and I stood there talking with the guard, never knowing whether my mother could see me. I later learned that she could see me, and that it gave her a tremendous boost. We knew that only a few people had ever come out of the SS prison alive, and we were willing to try anything to get my mother released. Her lover, Herbert Langer, was powerless to help. He had fainted when he learned of her arrest, even though he sat on the Altenrat. In our desperation, my father and I went to František Weidmann, the former chairman of the Prague Jewish community. He was a fat man with whom my father used to play bridge in Prague. He had lost a lot of weight in the camp, but he was still fat. Like Herbert, Weidmann was now an influential figure in Terezin. He told us that he could not intercede, but he suggested that the three of us, my father, Bobby and I, volunteer for a transport that was scheduled to leave in 2 days, on the chance that the SS would let my mother join us. We were aware that the transport was going east, to an unknown destination, and also that relatives and friends who had left in previous transports had never been heard from again. We were not aware that it was going directly to Auschwitz. I will never know whether Weidmann knew where he was sending us, since he perished in October 1944 after being sent to Auschwitz himself. According to revelations in post-war studies, it is possible that at the time he had information about the gas changers. Faced with an impossible decision, my father turned to me, and perhaps momentarily forgetting that I was only 12, asked me what I thought we should do. Since our arrival in Terezin, he had changed. In Prague, he had been the undisputed head of our family. I adored him and thought him infinitely wise. My mother, who had married him when she was 19 and he was 30, never questions his decisions. Coming to Terezin was, of course, a shock to all of us. But it was my father who found it most difficult to adjust. He had run his family's chemical factories. Now he had no control over his own life or that of his family. He once said, "Whatever choice we make, it is the wrong one." I think that, unlike many Terezin inmates, he saw the Nazis' intentions clearly. And after 20 years, his marriage was about to end because my mother was in love with another man. By today's standards, my parents' marriage was not a conventional one. But it never occurred to me that they wouldn't stay together. My father was loving and affectionate with my mother. Though he was not monogamous, she didn't seem to object. He clearly liked beautiful women, some of them well-known and not necessarily in a good way. Before he married my mother, he had a relationship with Leni Riefenstahl, who went on to achieve fame first as an actress and then for the Nazi propaganda films she directed. I grew up wanting to be a dancer, and when I leaped around our apartment, it was the family joke that I had inherited my desire to dance from Lenny, who had started off as a dancer. Another of my father's mistresses was the great beauty Suzanne Renzetti, the granddaughter of a Silesian rabbi, and by then the wife of an Italian government official. I was supposedly named after Susie. My mother did not mind her staying with us and on her occasional visits to Prague, but I did, because I had to cede to her my beautiful room, decorated in my favorite shade of blue. Susie's husband, Giuseppe Renzetti, later became the pro-Nazi Italian consul general in Berlin, where he and Susie socialized with high-level Nazis, including Hitler. I told myself that my father could not possibly have foreseen the two women's involvement with the Nazis. Sometimes I wondered, but did not dare ask why he had not asked either of them for help. By then, my father must have realized that his decision not to immigrate had been a fatal error. In 1938, when my parents finally applied for a visa to Colombia, we were required to convert to Catholicism. Mr. Yasatko, the family chauffeur, drove the four of us to Hradec Králové, a town about 60 miles from Prague, where a friendly priest was willing to baptize us. The next day, we had to receive communion, and my father choked on the wafer. Even though my parents regarded conversion as a necessary formality, it made them extremely uneasy. While they were not observant Jews, they had always frowned on converts. But despite the conversion, we did not immigrate. I don't know whether we were unable to obtain an exit permit or whether my father was perhaps reluctant to leave his mother, my grandmother Tina, behind. She later perished in Treblinka. At any rate, by the time it became clear that immigration was our only hope, it was too late. It was during the German occupation, when we were still in Prague, that my mother fell in love with Herbert Langer. He was part of my parents' new all-Jewish social circle. Though they were secretly in touch with many of their old Gentile friends, Jews and Gentiles had been forbidden to associate. Apparently, Herbert had met and admired my mother at the Spindle ski resort before the war. She did not remember him, but she knew that years earlier his father and my paternal grandfather had founded an orphanage together. Even though Herbert was married by the time of the German occupation, he was besotted with my mother, and when he and his wife, Goethe, arrived in Terezin 2 days after we did, he began to visit us in the attic almost every day. My mother responded to the stresses of life in Terezin better than my father did. She was now the stronger of the two. She had a physically demanding job, the cleaning brigade, scrubbing office floors on her knees at night, and although she was not accustomed to physical labor and her hands were red and swollen, she handled the job well and was liked by her fellow workers. To my eyes, my parents still treated each other with affection, as they always had. My father seemed to go along with Herbert's presence in our lives, but I could only imagine how he felt. Though he never lost his biting sense of humor, it turned dark. His witty puns became more sad than funny. He did not look well. He had lost a lot of weight, and his face had an unhealthy color. I used to watch him and worry about him. But I could not tell what exactly was wrong with him. Bobby thought he was suffering from cancer. When my father asked me, after my mother's arrest and our visit to Weidmann, whether I thought we should volunteer for a transport, I was shocked that he wanted to include me in such an important decision. I knew that leaving for the unknown would be dangerous, but what frightened me most was the thought that it would be up to me to pack up all our possessions. They were mostly stored in a suitcase under my mother's bed. In her absence, I had frequently rushed to retrieve various items from it, and what was left of the flour we had brought with us from Prague 6 months earlier had spilled onto our clothes. The result was a mess that I couldn't cope with. Without mentioning the reason, I told my father that we shouldn't volunteer. I have often wondered whether he took my opinion into account, and I felt ashamed that I let such a trivial and selfish motive guide me in a decision that might have resulted in my mother's release from prison. In the end, whatever his reasons, my father decided against signing us up for the transport. In doing so, he saved our lives. I know now that we would not have passed the Auschwitz selection process. My mother was sick and weak after her imprisonment in a freezing cell. Bobby was paralyzed, and I was small for my age. We would have been deemed unfit for work and sent to the gas chambers. In my memory, it seems as though my mother remained in prison for months. But according to my diary, she was away from us for 3 weeks. Against all reason, we never gave up hope that she would be released. Late one afternoon, my father came to the attic and sat on my bed, as he always used to do after work, while I toasted him a piece of precious rye bread on the communal stove. In the evening, most of the women who lived in the attic would push and shove one another to get close to the stove, and since they towered over me and I was not strong enough to squeeze by them, I always cooked in the afternoon. While I was standing at the stove, my mother appeared at the attic entrance. Her beautiful face was thin and pale and looked incongruous atop her body, made bulky by the many layers of clothing she had managed to put on when she was arrested. In fact, she later told me, when they let her go, she did not return directly to the attic. Two ghetto policewomen took me to Magdeburg, the Magdeburg barracks, where I had to fill out many papers, she recalled. Then I asked to see Herbert. He was sitting at his desk with his head in his hands. He turned around and saw me. He cried so much. I looked terrible. I said I had to go home. We ran all the way. When we got there, I said, "You'd better not go with me." He agreed. I walked up to the attic and stood in the door. I said, "Vicky." This was one of my mother's names for my father. And when he saw me, he also cried. It was only recently, when I reread my mother's recollections of her return, that I realized they did not include me. For several days, she lay in bed and hardly spoke. And then she began to talk to my father about what she had seen and experienced. She whispered the story so that I would not hear, but still I overheard some. When they first brought her to the prison, she said, "An SS man kicked me in the ass and I fell into the cell." Other than that, she herself was not physically abused, although she saw some of the terrible things that the SS did to the other prisoners. They interrogated her every day, but she continued to deny any involvement in the food smuggling operation. At one point, one of her jailers questioned her about her terrorism job. She said that she scrubbed floors, and he told her to show him her hands. When he saw how red they were, he seemed pleased, perhaps by the thought of how far she had fallen. Miraculously, they finally let her go. Why they did so remains a mystery. My fear about including the story of my mother's imprisonment in the diary is understandable. But when I first reread it, I was stunned to discover that it contained no mention either of Bobby's illness or of my parents' marital situation, two topics that never left my thoughts. One evening, about a week after our arrival in Terezin, Bobby came to visit my mother and me in the attic. I was lying down on my bed because I was tired. He told us he was not feeling well and lay down next to me. When it was time for him to return to his barracks and he tried to get up, he fell and was unable to move. His was the first case in the camp's polio epidemic. Amazingly, even though I had lain in bed right next to him, I was never infected. During the first weeks, we did not know whether he would live. My parents went to see him every day. Since children were not allowed to visit the polio ward, I waited in the attic for news of his condition. For several months, he remains paralyzed from the waist down. I was afraid that he would die, but gradually he got better and began to regain the use of his legs. Although the polio left him with permanently weakened stomach muscles and a slight limp. A week after he was released from the polio ward, he was given a diagnosis of tuberculosis and hospitalized again. Once, when I was sitting with some children in the courtyard on a high horizontal beam used for drying laundry, my mother and Herbert walked under us holding hands. It was almost dark, and they did not see me. I could only hope that none of the other children had recognized him. I resented Herbert and his intrusion into our family, and for a long time I refused to speak to him. Herbert frequently visited Bobby in the hospital, and Bobby seemed to accept and even like him. My mother once told me that when Bobby became paralyzed and lost all will to live, Herbert did more than anyone to restore his spirit. All I can remember about Herbert now is his large brown eyes, magnified by his thick glasses, and how sad he often seemed. I have forgotten when and why I stopped disliking him. I never had a chance to get to know him well enough to find out what made my mother love him. Nor will I ever know whether my father was aware of the true nature of my mother and Herbert's affair. On certain occasions, instead of addressing my father as Vicky or Vikinek for Victor, she called him Otilka, their half-joking code word for a jealous spouse, as in Othello. But the last time I heard my mother call my father Otilka was long before she grew close to Herbert. Although Herbert could not get my mother released when she was jailed by the SS, it is very likely that on many occasions he saved our lives. When a transport east was to leave Terezin, the SS determined the number and the category of prisoners, sometimes only able-bodied young men, sometimes the sick and the old, to be deported. But it was up to the members of the Jewish administration, often including the Council of Elders, to fill in the names of specific individuals. The council members were hated by most of the other inmates. Many participated in this dreadful process in the hope that they could save themselves and their families, since each member was permitted to draw up a list of 30 people who were to be charini, protected from the transports. My mother later told me that she, my father, Bobby, and I were on Herbert's list. However, during September and October of 1944, when 18,000 Terezin prisoners were shipped to Auschwitz in a series of 11 transports, which left almost no men under the age of 40 in the camp, the Jews lost all control over the list. In the end, this task was taken over by the SS, and no prisoners were protected any longer. My father was deported to Auschwitz in the 8th transport on October 16th and died in the gas chambers. My mother, Bobby, and I were spared, owing not to Herbert's protection, but to chance. The Nazis who drew up the list passed us by. Herbert and his wife, they had no children, left Terezin in the final transport, the 11th, with members of the Council of Elders. Before leaving, he gave my mother three small envelopes marked with our names and told her they contained a fast-working poison, in case we needed it. He planned to use it himself on the train. He also gave her a letter to deliver, if she survived, to a sister who had immigrated to the United States. Here is Herbert's letter. Terezin, October 27th, 1944. My dear Ellie, our father was arrested on September 6th, 1941, and on November 11th, 1941, he died. He was an honorable, good man. The last message he sent me, saying that he was all right, was delivered to me here last year by someone who had shared his suffering. Our Tatanek, Daddy, lived up to his obligations, but his actions were not reciprocated. Since 1939, filled with ideals, I have worked hard to fulfill my obligations to those who, like me, face persecution and oppression. I regret that I will never be able to describe what I experienced and what I saw. I ask one thing of you. Do believe that everything you will hear is true. Nothing that you will hear can compare with what I knew about and witnessed. My participation in these events has always been impartial and honest. Except for our father, up until today, thank God, I was able to save our whole family from the terrible fate that befell tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. Tomorrow, my family and the family of my Goethe must begin the journey that was taken by thousands before them. If God is merciful, they may survive these terrible times. Unfortunately, after tomorrow, I will not be able to watch over them or help them anymore. I hope that there will be someone who will look after them. I hope that the good I have done in the past will be of some benefit to them. Tomorrow I will leave, separately from the rest of my family. After tomorrow, you will never hear from me again. I will vanish into the endless nothingness to join those who had to pay for what they knew and witnessed, while for many years the whole world watched with folded arms. We are at war. We are the enemies, and we have to know how to die like soldiers. In the next 48 hours, my fate will be sealed, and my wife's, Gertis, as well. All I ask of you is to take care of our father's grave, and if you should find us, to bury us next to him. Help our family and Gertis as much as you can. Help them forget. They will need your help. Be well. I wish you and Max and Gretel much happiness, and never forget that what you will hear cannot be compared to the reality of what people had to live through. Your Herbert. When the 11th transport arrived in Auschwitz, the members of the Council of Elders on it were executed. The Nazis wanted no witness to their actions to survive. We had talked endlessly about the moment when it will end, and dreamed of the return of those who had left on transports into the unknown. But the end of the war was nothing like what we had envisioned. For most of us, there were no reunions. We learned what had happened to our loved ones in late April of 1945, when cattle cars filled with half-dead ex-prisoners and corpses began to arrive back in Terezin. Among the survivors were former Terezin inmates who told us about Auschwitz. One friend, Carol Gross, who had left Terezin on the same transport as my father, told my mother that he had seen Mengele send my father to the wrong side. But since there was no proof of his death, for many years I didn't accept it. In the early 50s, when I was a student at Vassar, I fantasized that he would visit me on campus. My mother, Bobby, and I remained in Terezin until May 1945, when the camp was liberated by the Soviet Army. After the war, my mother always spoke of Vikenek and Herbert in the same loving manner. She had several opportunities to remarry, but she never did. She told me that she would have married Herbert if he had lived. I could never bring myself to ask her why she preferred him to my father. She was more than 10 years older than Herbert. Perhaps he aroused protective maternal feelings that my much older father could not. It was unthinkable for me to bring up the thorny question of whether there had been an element of calculation in their relationship. Besides, if his position of authority, his power to protect us from the transports, had motivated her in any way, I do not believe she would have admitted it even to herself. I do think she truly loved him. My mother died in 1990 at the age of 86. Just before Herbert left for Auschwitz, he gave me his little red Czech English dictionary, which I still use. When I recently looked up his date of birth, I learned that he was only 30 when he died. Bobby inherited my father's extraordinary gift for humor and wordplay, and as J.R. Pick became one of Czechoslovakia's leading satirical writers. Despite his poor health, he began to publish right after the war and never stopped writing, even when the communists banned his work in 1969. He never fully recovered from the tuberculosis he contracted in Terezin, and I continued to worry about his health until he died at the age of 57 in 1983. When I was imprisoned in Terezin, I wanted to pour out my feelings in my diary, but I was unable to put them into words. I recorded some everyday events, but my deepest emotions and fears remained unspoken. The diary contains only hints of how unhappy I was. The thought that Bobby could die was so frightening to me that I could not bring myself to mention his illness. As for my mother's affair with Herbert, it so profoundly embarrassed and disturbed me that his name never appears in the diary. I was caught between my love for my father and my need to learn to accept Herbert. These were confusing emotions that I was incapable of expressing then. More than that, I was unable to deal with the guilt and shame of being protected by my mother's lover, while others were being sent on the transports to die. And these feelings have remained with me to this day. They must be the reason it has taken me so long to tell this story. And now a poem, "The Man Who Owned Me" by Tracy K. Smith. It was a man, I'm sure of it. Though I never saw him, I felt him rise, climbing up through me until I bent to a devotion not my own. I felt him in my belly, low in my hips. I carried him like I carried my own children. I have no idea if he was old or young, what his face would have been had he flesh. He did in me whatever an ember does, burning slowly until all of a piece. What it feeds on falls to ash. Sometimes I miss what he taught me, to see the hunger it gave me. I think he must wait now, just beside my body, believing I'll one day fall back to my knees. If he had hands, they would be the kind of hands I open for. We've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.